Service for Christmas Eve. It's led by the Dean of King's, the Reverend Dr. Stephen Cherry. Here on FM, our Book of the Week this week is a seasonal selection for clear and wintry nights, Stories in the Stars by Susanna Hislop and Hannah Waldron. It uncovers some of the global myths and astronomical facts that lie behind the patterns of the constellations. Today's episode ranges from ancient Greece to contemporary New York.
Andromeda, the Chained Maiden. Look up and as far away as you can see. Can you spot it? Something flickering in faraway intensity. Something 2.5 million light years away that is hurtling towards you at 300 kilometers a second. Squint really hard. There it is. The Andromeda Galaxy, with its celestial motorway of a name, the M31. It is the most distant object you can see with your naked human eye and the closest spiral galaxy to Earth. Hurtling eternally towards me is Cetus, the deranged sea monster, a dragonfish, a sea serpent, a great whale, but always a she. They always are fishy monsters, aren't they? If you look up from the Northern Hemisphere at 8 o'clock in mid-December, you will see fierce Cetus rising towards the ecliptic, lunging towards me from the southern depths with only the twin fish of Pisces standing in her way. And here am I, the original maiden in distress, the woman chained, who awaits her knight in shining armour, whose own parents strung her to a rock. To see how I ended up in this star-framed family horror show, read about my mother, Cassiopeia, the bitch. The horror of my fate still lingers in the Sanskrit tongue. Their word, Medha, carrying the bloody echoes of ancient sacrifice. But if you name a girl Medha, that means she has an intellect illuminated by love, which I like to think is about right. Because this much is true, ladies and gentlemen, I was saved by love. Strapped to the rocks of Joppa and screaming out to sea, I caught the beady eye of Perseus. Apparently, I blushed in shame and couldn't speak. But that's a lie. I blushed in raging lust. I apologize for trampling all over the history books with the not-so-virgin truth of my girlhood. A cheeky fumble in the olive groves here, a naughty nuzzle behind the chariot shed there. But those poets get on my tits. When gorgeous Percy swooped to my rescue on a massive white horse, not fluttering on winged sandals, Ovid, I was gloriously naked, except for some impressive bling. Something you understood when you started your star atlases, before modesty shrouded the centuries and you covered me up. Like those Arabian astronomers who, scared to draw the human form, turned me into a fat little sea calf. Thanks a bunch. They kept me in chains, though, of course. I think I like the way Rubens painted me best. But if you want a sense of how voluptuously large I really am, that spiral galaxy your scientists have so romantically named M31 is nestled safely close to my right hip.
Ursa Major, the Great Bear. This is it. The one you know. The thing you might actually recognise in the night sky. The Big Dipper, the saucepan, the plough. Call it what you like. The famous star pattern, or asterism, at the heart of Ursa Major is one of the very few that actually looks like the things it's meant to resemble. This is the stargazer's starting block. For once you have delightedly joined up the dots of these seven bright stars to form a celestial ladle, you can then easily follow the line of the ladle's far edge. From the star Merak to Dubi, straight up to Polaris in Ursa Minor. This is the North Star, our current pole star. But Polaris has not always been our pole star, the point that stands almost perfectly still as the heavens spin around it. When Ptolemy was mapping the stars in the 2nd century AD, it was in fact 11 degrees away. This is because of something called precession, the slow but incremental process by which the Earth wobbles on its rotational axis. About once every 26,000 years, the axis completes one precessional cycle, tracing out the shape of a cone, which all means that the position of the stars moves about 1 degree every 72 years. But why am I harping on about an astronomical phenomenon? Let's kick off our slippers, sit back and enjoy the story. Are you ready? Then I'll begin. Zeus, of course, was king of the gods. His sister, Hera, was also his wife, and the children he fathered left, right and centre were many. One of his illegitimate daughters was Artemis, the goddess of the hunt, and of lions and stags and all things wild. Now Artemis would range through the forests and the plains with her bow and arrows and a loyal band of nymphs who had sworn a solemn vow of chastity to the goddess. And one of those feral virgins was Callisto. One day, as this pretty little wood nymph was out picking a fine branch to hew into an arrow, she caught the eye of Zeus. Disguising himself as Artemis, he approached the naive Callisto. She turned and saw her leader and smiled. But before Callisto knew what was happening, Artemis was suddenly Zeus. The branch in her palm had slipped from her grip, and her innocence and chastity had been slashed and burnt in one fell swoop. Whether she bore the god's child straight away, or gestated in the woods for a more quotidian 9 months, we can't be sure. What we do know is that their offspring was a boy called Arcas, and that he was brought up by his grandfather, Lycaon, a very nasty man. But this is the story of Ursa Major, and currently, Callisto is roaming alone through the forests as precisely that, a great bear. For that is what Zeus's jealous wife, Hera, turned her into in a rage. She made thick brown hairs sprout from Callisto's fine skin, and her slender spine and limbs curve over and squat into an ursine stoop. The years passed, 14, perhaps 15, and it was a bright autumn morning and light streamed down through the canopy. Hearing some unusually heavy rustling in the leaves, Callisto turned to see a teenage huntsman aiming his arrow directly at her. Immediately, and with a mother's love, she knew it was her son. As she cried and wept and called out his name, Arcas, of course, heard only the loud growls of a bear. Terrified of the raging creature, he bent back his bow. As fate would have it, the gods intervened. Zeus got wind of the ursine matricide about to occur, and, in the divine nick of time, turned young Arcas into a bear as well, so that he could understand his mother's cries. Then, so as not to be scratched by their sharp claws, he picked them both up by their tails and spun them round and round and lassoed them into the sky. That is why, incidentally, unlike ordinary bears, Ursa Major and Ursa Minor have such long tails. But ever jealous Hera was not satisfied with this. Travelling to the underwater palace of her brother Poseidon, king of the sea, she persuaded him never to let the bears enjoy bathing in the heavenly waters. Poseidon granted his sister's vindictive wish, and that is why, for most of the Northern Hemisphere, where the story began, the stars of Ursa Major and Ursa Minor will never dip below the horizon. Conversely, for those stargazers living south of Rio de Janeiro or Alice Springs, these two bears will never rise.
Monoceros, the unicorn.
There is no such things as unicorns, Peabrain,
her brother smirked.
Or Father Christmas. Unicorns are just something you get in Alice in Wonderland. And Father Christmas was made up by capitalism.
He pronounced the last word with particular pride. Betty watched in disgust as her brother guzzled his Milky Way bar. He didn't even know his seven times tables, and whenever Mom tested him in the car, Dad secretly mouthed the answers to him in the rearview mirror. She thought with pleasure of the fact that soon he would have eaten all his chocolate and opened all the presents from his stocking, while her careful, steady pace meant that she had still only unwrapped one gift, a pinkly, glittering My Little Pony. She would have lots left, and he would be really annoyed.
There is tis such a thing as a unicorn, she said calmly. They knew about them in ancient India and China, and you can see pictures of one fighting a lion from 3,500 years ago. And also, medieval tapestries tell you how to hunt one, which is basically that you get something called a virgin. And then the unicorn, which is usually really shy, comes and sits in her lap, and she strokes its head, and it falls asleep, and then they catch it. Which is all to do with something called paganism and...
Her brother, whose mouth had fallen agog mid-Milky Way some time ago, leapt to attention, sensing a moment to pounce.
Fertility, she continued hurriedly, and falling in love and magic... But that's before the Christians came along and stole the unicorn from the pagans and said it was actually called Jesus and that the virgin woman was called Mary and it was all about something called the Passion, which I think is a bit like the fruit, except that in the medieval tapestry, it's a pomegranate. And Pooh Brain, the unicorn, is in Through the Looking Glass in a song about plum cake and a fight between Scotland and England that happened in real life. And that's why there's all those lions and unicorns in Buckingham Palace.
And if you still don't believe in unicorns, his little sister said defiantly,
go and look through a telescope and you can see one, except it's called Monoceros because you have to call the animals in the stars by their Latin names. You can see its horn, which is a cone-shaped pillar of dust and gas 2,700 light years away, which is even more magic than anyone ever imagined because it makes actual stars, and it made a beautiful pattern of them called the Christmas tree star cluster. So, Peabrain, there are such things as unicorns, and there probably is a Father Christmas too.
Nama Dumezwini, Jessica Gunning and Coleman Domingo were reading from Stories in the Stars by Susanna Hislop. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. On Women's Hour After the News, Jane Garvey catches up with a pair who were the first women in their families to go to university. It's 25 years since the first Wallace and Gromit film was released, and tomorrow Sue McGregor talks to the creative team behind the animation. Its creator Nick Park and the co-founder of Aardman, Peter Lord, explain how Peter Salice's voice influenced the shape and movement of Wallace's face.
It was the way Peter said, cheese, I think it was, or crackers. We forgot the crackers.
Because we visited the film school at this time. And we saw the first take of that shot. And you seldom do two takes in animation if you can avoid it. But the first one, he said, we've forgotten the crackers in a fairly modest way. And the second time, with this big, exaggerated, rubbery mouth. And you laughed when you saw it.
The reunion is at 7 tomorrow morning and then available on the Radio 4 website.